This is WHFR Dearborn, and now it's time for our public affairs show, the new WHFR Journal. Okay, let's get down to the bones of it. Bad joke, since that's the theme from the TV show Bones, but people say they like that better for this show. The other one they thought was a little too easygoing, and since we're local news and alternative views, well, we just, we want to keep making waves. That's our station motto, our slogan, in fact. I'm Jay Koronick, and I'm with you today as host, along with Susan Morell, who is our WHFR news director and co-host. Good afternoon, Susan.
Good afternoon, Jay. It is a beautiful day here in Michigan. I have to give our updated weather report, of course, for anyone who is listening who may not be in the Michigan area. They may be listening online at WHFR.FM anywhere in the world. And it's a beautiful sunny day with a beautiful breeze, and the spring trees and the leaves are out and the birds are singing. And it's going to be about 74 degrees, or maybe around 70s.
Well, that's great to know for the people who listen to this some other day online. yes, it is great. We're having a lot of fun here before it gets too hot. It's certainly not too cold. It's just right. I wanted to mention that this morning I went out for breakfast at Coney Island place nearby my house, and there was George Hart himself, a former senator, Michigan to the Michigan legislature from this area, former Dearborn councilman, and as I mentioned last week, he's now taken out a petition, and he's going to be one of the candidates in the primary, which has to whittle down the candidates for Dearborn City Council, so that only the whatever the number is that can run in November. So there's going to be a primary in August, after Dearborn Homecoming, of course, while all the candidates get to walk around and shake hands. And we know George is just wonderful at shaking hands. In fact, he remembered me, of all things.
Everyone remembers you, Jay.
Oh, I hope that's good. But as a radio person, and I haven't actually met him in person for, maybe 8 or 10 years. Of course, we did play his recording of Apple Blossom Time here on this station back in the 80s.
Hey.
Late 80s. He was trying to make Apple Blossom Time, sung by himself, as the state song.
Oh, my goodness.
Apparently, Michigan does not have a state song, or if it does, it's nothing as pretty as Apple Blossom Time, in his opinion. And I remember we played it a couple times. We don't have that. It was a record. Yes, it was vinyl.
Well, the singing, singing voice must be rather impressive.
Well, he was telling me, because we've reflected on that, one of the biggest Tiger games in 1968 down at Old Briggs Stadium, he actually got to sing the national anthem.
Wow. Well, that's an honor.
Yeah. And he said everybody loved it. Well, of course. They just want to get on with the game. Yeah, he's done. No, I'm sorry, George. But so we wish him and the other candidates well. We may probably be talking to them all at homecoming from our booth out there. We invite all the candidates to come by our live broadcast booth at Dearborn Homecoming in Dearborn's beautiful Ford Field. I was just wondering whether or not he lives in my area. I've never seen him there before. Maybe he's making the rounds of breakfast restaurants as part of his plan to meet and greet everybody.
He's making his connections.
That's right. He's renewing his connections. So.
Yes.
And he was talking to my granddaughter, who's 1.5, and she didn't talk back, but she was smiling. He was making goo-goo eyes at her. So.
Well, how is the granddaughter these days? Is she still chubby, or is she growing?
Chubby? When was she ever chubby?
Most babies are chummy. Chubby.
It's just baby fat. It's just a little baby fat. And she's doing fine. Thank you. Okay, let's move on to the events of the day. We have, just like it says on our WHFR.FM website, a special guest that we're going to try to connect with, technology allowing, of course. At about 1:30, and we'll be placing that call ourselves. It'll be very exciting. You can actually listen as we're placing the call on the air. And it's arranged to be with Mark Gaffney, who is the president of the Michigan chapter of the AFL-CIO. sort of an umbrella organization of skill craft guild unions, which in fact feature even my teachers union here at Henry Ford Community College, at least when I was a full-time person. Now I'm part-time, and so I have a different union. But I think they're both affiliated with AFL-CIO, so American Federation of Teachers, one of many unions, in fact, over 65. So we'll talk more about AFL-CIO. Susan Morrell, you were good enough to get that set up. Just to let our listeners know, AFL-CIO, you might just think of it in regard to the UAW, but 65 different unions that are all part of their organization, including the Air Pilots Association, the National Air Traffic Controllers, which is good, one union talking to the other, you know, so they can land the planes, National Postal Mail Handlers Union, they're inside the building, and then the National Association of Letter Carriers, those are the people outside the building. It's interesting they had to have two separate unions there, because they have two separate different kinds of jobs, you know, I guess. And United American Nurses, Writers Guild of America East, so people that do script writing east of the Mississippi, AFL-CIO, but the Writers Guild of America West, which is all the Hollywood movies, they're a union, but they're apparently not affiliated, because they weren't on the list with the AFL-CIO. That's kind of, I don't know about that. Of course, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, whatever, AFSCME, and there's a lot of those. Wayne County, of course, employees would be part of AFSCME. In terms of movies, the American Federation of TV and Radio Artists, AFTRA, and Screen Actors Guild, SAG, SAG. They're all parts, and that's just a couple. I mean, there's electricians and welders and all kinds of unions that usually associated by their guild, by their craft, that are part of this. And, of course, you wanted to get this interview on the air because right now their two main issues that they've been fighting is Employee Free Choice Act and also health care, too, which I, you know, went into for some time last week. And they also have on their website something called Executive Pay Watch.
Mm-hmm. And they also have something called Hire Michigan First. Right. It's a legislative package.
Yeah.
So we want to have Mr. Gaffney address all of these issues and inform us here on WHFR and inform all of our listeners so we can be aware of what is happening.
Well, in that spirit, why don't you start with the first story, which I pulled from the New York Times website just this morning, just minutes ago. Talk about hot off the printing press, or our printer anyway, here at WHFR. What's the current status with the GM situation? Are they going to go bankrupt or not? Please share that story with our listeners.
Yes, we have a story. It's about GM and the union reaching a deal on concessions, which everybody really wants to know what's going on. General Motors reached a deal with its union this Thursday and is now racing the clock to persuade its bondholders, remember them, to eliminate $27 billion in debt and avoid a bankruptcy filing. GM has until Tuesday, that would be this coming Tuesday, to persuade thousands of bondholders to agree to swap their debt for equity, which would fulfill its last significant requirement for restructuring ordered by President Obama. But there does appear to be a little chance that the required 90% of bondholders will agree to these terms, making the prospect of bankruptcy increasingly likely for GM and the nation's largest automaker. This is very sad. Analysts said that the United Automobile Workers, that's the UAW, their deal with GM, which followed similar concessions to Chrysler's deal, will increase the pressure on bondholders to accept the company's offer. I think there's a shot it will succeed, but a very small one, says David Cole, the chairman for the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Of course, we know where that is. A coalition of small bondholders protested the terms of GM's offer in Washington on Thursday. Do you believe that? They're out there protesting in Washington, D.C. That's unbelievable.
Well, those are small bondholders. the large, as you're going to mention, the large bondholders, they get to stay in their offices and just complain by telephone.
Yes, they have also, the large ones have also opposed the deal, which calls for them to receive 225 shares of GM stock in exchange for each $1,000 worth of debt. Do you think that's a good deal,
Jay? Well, it's a definite deal. You know, the problem is the future is unknown, and so if you buy into, as the healthcare pension did, the equity of GM, as the U.S. government did, as the article mentions, the U.S. government through the Treasury Department now owns 50% equity in GM, sort of the controlling share. And, you know, maybe that GM, if he ever gets successful, it will be able to buy that share back. But at this point, not. So it, again, if the whole company goes bankrupt, if people don't buy GM cars, you know, a guarantee amount of money on your dollar is better than, you know, just an equity, because the future of the equity may be almost, I think GM shares are less than a dollar each right now, even, so it's...
Right, but what is $1,000 of debt worth? What is that worth? I mean,
yeah,
that might not
be,
you know, if they go into bankruptcy, they may not get that much either.
That's right. So it's...
It's a toss-up.
You're going to lose no matter what, but then again, whose fault was that? I think it's pretty clear that, yes, the economy has hurt every business to a certain extent, not all businesses. Somebody on Fox News, of course, Fox News, cable TV, were saying, oh, a lot of businesses are having a great time right now. They're doing fantastic.
Well, who are they? Where are they?
I don't know. The people that repossess homes, I don't know.
Right.
The repo men are doing great right now.
Absolutely.
But there are, for example, if people turn to buying less expensive products, we know Walmart is doing more sales now than ever before because they are known, I'm not sure if it's totally true, but they're known for having lower prices.
Right, but they have lower prices, but in the meantime, their prices are going up because they know that people need lower prices. They're coming to them for a reason, so they're not going to lower their prices anymore. They're going to keep them a little bit higher, and then that way they can increase their profitability. But also, credit counselors are doing well these days.
Sure, yeah. But, you know, difficult economic times, but that doesn't explain why GM has not had ability to compete with the Japanese car manufacturers, whether it's hybrids or not. You know, the fact that they've become anti-competitive, those were decisions not of the auto union, you know, but the management. And so it was a badly run company. Ford has been better run, but they're still way behind in terms of fuel efficiency, but they're trying to catch up. I mean, they did the turnaround before Chrysler and GM, and they borrowed extra money to carry them over, and so they had good leadership, you know, even though it took them about 10 years to get the message about the competition from foreign car manufacturers and the new technology. And now they got some pretty good cars, although... Supposedly the government is going to stand behind any GM or Chrysler car you might buy, so in terms of warranty, so that's not a, you know, a negative thing. I'm just saying is that the fault here is not just the economy, because that reduces auto sales, but it's clearly management's fault. You know, GM had that electric car. I hate to keep hitting on this. You know, rent the DVD, folks. The documentary said, who killed the electric car? It was GM. They had a great electric car, not the Volt, but an all-electric car back in the 90s. And it had a great successful one-year test of 200 or 300 models or more in California. Tom Hanks had one and was on Jay Leno's show talking about how great it was. That's part of the documentary, Who Killed the Electric Car. And it had a good, you know, it had old-fashioned batteries even. But GM said, well, we don't think anybody wants to buy them. Well, everybody that had one wanted to buy one, you know, and they just pulled them all back because it was the least thing and crushed them all, destroyed them all. Yep.
Not a very good plan.
I mean... Even a dimwit, if you had a bad car, but if you had a car that anybody wanted, you'd still sell them. I mean, why just crush them? Why go to the cost of crushing them into dust?
Well, I mean,
out of embarrassment or something?
No, but Jay,
almost all those people that had them wanted to buy it.
But Jay, it's just like what they're doing with all these big, beautiful homes that have been built, and they've gone, you know... bust, nobody can live in them, people have lost their homes, and they're going in with a wrecking crew and demolishing brand new homes that have just been built. I mean, we have thousands of homeless people in the country. these homes could be used. They could somehow be turned over. And they're going in there and they're demolishing them after all this investment.
It's a different kind of deconstruction, but I agree with you. A lot of these things don't make sense in the long term. And there's a lot of very selfish short-term thinking going on. Another documentary feature film that just came out, even though these things are always dated, but it's on DVD, IOUSA.
Oh, yes, that's so scary.
Yeah, the book came out 2 years ago, and from the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, David Walker, who's their CEO, has been going around on this publicity tour for the last couple of years telling people how bad the national debt is. And this is before the crisis happened. In fact, the movie was released and premiered last fall before the worst of the crisis. The big bailout was just starting to be, I think at the end of September was when the movie was actually released to the theaters. But there's an update section that's on the DVD, a comment by David Walker from this last January, anyway, just a couple months ago, about how bad the situation really is now. And as they said in that film, is the American public, they probably won't do anything until there's a crisis, darn it. And although they were recommending that we do something.
We are in a crisis.
Well, right. So let's hope we do the right thing now that we're in the crisis. And what was interesting was that they had everyone from Warren Buffett in a live presentation, an hour-long discussion after the movie premiered, and that was on the DVD also. That's another hour of programming that was there. And again, this is IOUSA, individual letters, okay, like, the USA owes a lot of money. We're deeply in debt, okay? And, of course, now worse than ever. I thought it was fascinating to hear Warren Buffett, the head of the gentleman, I can't remember his name now, head of the Cato Institute, the president of AARP, the American Association of Retired Persons, plus Peter Peterson and David Walker. They were all on the stage in this formal presentation discussion with a live audience, or live at the time anyway, after they saw the movie and asking questions. But things are so much worse now. And what I wanted to say was, as they pointed out then, if an objective bipartisan task force could be appointed to draw up the plans, even though they represent liberals, conservatives, business, labor, retirees, they could work out an answer to most of the economic problems.
Right, but that's, unfortunately, that is not happening.
No, and because of politics.
And the people who are in charge of the current economic recovery plan are the people who are part of President Obama's cabinet, Timothy Geithner and Larry Summers. And I think we've discussed here on the new WHFR Journal that we are not in agreement with many of the things that they are doing and the directions they are going in. Although Obama is providing very good leadership, and we are going in a much better direction than we were, and we do trust his leadership. But it's just some of the people around him we're not too happy with. But I did see parts of that movie, IOU. I didn't see the whole thing.
IOUSA.
And it was truly, truly frightening.
Yeah, they did run segments from it a couple times on MSNBC when they did some specials about the crisis, and they had David Walker on as a primary spokesperson at that time too. So it's fascinating. Things are a lot worse than what the movie even suggested, and things weren't good then. And they didn't point out it was a problem with liberals or conservatives, just a problem with the system, and a lot of self-indulgence and a lack of regulations like the financial.
But the problem is that we are in a crisis, and unfortunately many, many people do not even realize that we are in a crisis, and their failure to acknowledge the situation, I think, will make it much worse down the road.
Yeah.
But this conclusion of this plan in this article that we were reading from the New York Times this morning, it just summarize the finality of the plan that was announced last month. The Treasury Department would control at least 50% of the stock in a restructured GM, a healthcare trust for the union retirees would have about 39%. And the bondholders would get 10% and current shareholders the remaining 1%.
Mm-hmm.
And the advisors to the committee of the biggest bondholders for GM have criticized the plan as unfair, and they've stated that it's designed to fail. So they're totally not in favor of what the president's solution to this dilemma is. So
yeah, but nobody knows whether it's going to fail or not, and it is wrong to not try to be optimistic about some of the plans that are being proposed and so on. So I've got a couple things from, we're going to make our phone call to the president of the AFL-CIO in just about 10 minutes now here on the new WHFR Journal. WHFR.fm, the station making waves from Henry Ford Community College. Susan Morrell and myself, Jay Koronek, with you today. Thank you for tuning in. Memorial Day weekend. We've got a little comment if we have time at the end about Memorial Day celebration. Of course, in Dearborn, there'll be a big parade Monday morning down Michigan Avenue. Parking is going to be a little restricted this year from what I read. I don't know where I read that, but you might try to get there early or bicycle in or something like that. Weather is expected to be good. Here's a story from the Wednesday Dearborn Times-Herald. The Dearborn City Council is expected to adopt a slimmer budget. They've had some budget hearings around town, public hearings. It will include a slight tax increase for residents, $3.6 million in spending reductions, and more cash taken out of reserve funds. We've had a fairly big reserve, but each year for the last, I think, about 10 years or so, they've taken a couple million out each year, so not much left. But we had more than perhaps what we needed a few years back. I guess it was good that we had that much there so that we don't have to cut too radically in any particular bad year. We just draw from that fund. While a general operating millage decreased slightly, a 13.5% hike in the garbage is always going up, isn't it? Stemming from a new waste contract, so it's more expensive to collect the waste apparently now, and so that's a portion of what the budget goes for. It'll combine with debt millage increases on the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center. I guess the value has gone up on that property, and combined sewer overflow project. That's the federally mandated project to keep our Rouge River from being contaminated by sewage during heavy downpour of rains. Okay, so but that's the $400 million project, not even done yet. But it says the largest portion of the increase is the CSO, which will expand from 1.6 mils to 2.23 mils. That's almost 0.6. That's almost 30% more. For a $10,000 house, the increase just for that CSO would equate to $78 from 2009. But it probably was only about $50 last year. I remember it was rumored when Mayor Guido was still alive and our mayor, it was rumored off the record. He said, well, you know, I've got to get maybe a federal appointment or something because as soon as the CSO costs start hitting people's budgets in Dearborn, I won't be reelected. Now, he didn't say that in public, but we understand that was his feeling. $400 million, folks, is what it's costing the city of Dearborn. $400 million for a city of about 95,000 residents. And sure, it's over time and all that, but it's starting to kick in now, folks. And they're still not done with the project, and costs are still going up. There's been some delays, of course, for this huge digging of tunnels, and it's unbelievable what's been happening here. Probably Mayor O'Reilly won't get any of the blame for this, of course, because even though he's the mayor. So anyway, that's so costs will be going up in terms of your taxes, folks, a little bit, even though not as much as it could be if we didn't have that fund balance. They're going to take $3.7 million out of the fund balance. Also, the city has investments. They took out investments, you know, in order to make money with some of their money. And the investments decreased 70% from a year ago. So you think your 401k has gone down? Folks, your shares that you bought, your funds, the city's went down 70%. And so the investment income is still $1.5 million, but last year it was $2.2 million. So we lost $700,000 there. So that just, you know, part of the problems, okay? Also, criminal fines, clearance cards, probation fees, and traffic fines are down 16% from last year. Darn, at a time of need, crime is down, and people are driving more slowly and parking legally. How does that happen, you know?
They're not driving.
you'd think there'd be more crime with more people out of work and so on, but...
Well, this is just for Dearborn.
Maybe we just can't catch them.
No, it depends on what city you're in. It depends on what city.
They're talking about Dearborn. That fines to criminals. I mean, if you did a crime and you got caught, and the judge said you owe this amount of money.
Right.
And that's decreasing. And
That's
probation
one.
Fees, traffic fines, down 16%. And building permits, of course, we can understand this, there's fewer people who have money enough to add on to their homes or build new buildings. And building permits, cost a little bit of money. 11% down in building permits.
Right.
Additionally, state revenue sharing, this is the fault of Lansing, of course, was cut by 5% or $470,000. So the state is not, and I know Mayor Guido and Mayor O'Reilly last couple of years are saying, we're not getting our fair share back. Well, guess what, folks? They cut it another 5%. So we're getting even less of a share than when it was a big complaint of Mayor Guido and Mayor O'Reilly when they first got in. So, but what can you do? The state's not doing so well either. So,
well, when you say crime is down, have there been cuts to the police department?
No, they can't. They may be in their general budget, but, you know, Dearborn has passed resolutions, and it's in the new charter. It's part of the charter that the number of police and the number of fire people has to be maintained constant.
Because the police force, the Michigan State Police, is being cut, and
and
in other cities, the police force is being cut due to budgetary concerns.
Right. Well, Dearborn, we didn't want that to happen, and even though Mayor Guido was actually against that, he said we need flexibility in a downtime of the budget, you know, to lay a few people off. Or if, as we just pointed out, if crime seems to be down, maybe we don't need so many officers patrolling. But the people of Dearborn said, we want that stable number always there, no matter what. So it's a budget priority. I mean, they can't decide to lay off a policeman or fireman in Dearborn.
Yeah, but I don't think that's the case in other nearby cities.
Yep.
It's a different story.
Just a couple of minutes, we'll make our phone call, but I just see, so the budget, anyway, the city is still decreasing the number of employees, and more than 80% of city revenues go to employee compensation packages, both their salaries and pensions and health insurance. That's pretty much the same way it is here at Henry Ford Community College. I think it's closer to 90% of our budget at the college, because we run very inexpensively, I mean, for all things considered, is salaries. Not that the salaries are that high, but I'm just saying we have a lot of people employed, and we try to maintain the grounds. They're starting a big parking lot repair project, and if you're a student here, folks, or you're coming to the college, starting next week, this is the first year of 3 years of major upgrades and improvements on our parking lots, our free parking lots for all of our students. And the southern side is going to be of our camp is going to be closed off as they start that work next week. So starting the 26th, is it Tuesday? Is it 25th? Isn't it? Well, whatever the date is, the 26th is when it's going to start. And it's you can't park on the south side, but there's west and north, you know, parking lots. So we'll be able to accommodate people starting in the fall. Those lots will be back in operation again, of course, when we need more space for more people. Okay, so that's the story there. Shall we try to place that call, Susan?
Yes, okay. Let's do it.
All right. So what I'm going to do is play some public service announcements and try to get the connection with the AFL-CIO here. And the phone number is?
And the phone number is here.
Right there. Okay. So we'll be right back after these important non-commercial announcements. WHFR.FM station. Making waves.
Making waves.
Yes, we are.
Hello, unemployment office.
Hi, I'm looking for a job in the video game industry.
Great, so you're a programmer?
No, I just play them.
Mm-hmm. Did you finish high school?
What game system is that for?
High school dropouts earn an average of 42% less than graduates.
Hello? Hello?
Some earn even less. Stay in school. Give yourself a chance. For more info, go to OperationGraduation.com. Brought to you by the U.S. Army and Ad Council.
Henry Ford Community College is a great way to get a valuable education at a lower cost. Visit hfcc.edu and compare for yourself. You'll see that the cost of 60 credit hours at Eastern Michigan University is $10,000 higher than the cost of 60 credit hours at Henry Ford Community College. It's $12,000 higher at Oakland University and $17,000 higher at University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Remember, we offer a four-year tuition freeze guarantee, which assures you that today's tuition rates will be frozen for students who graduate from HFCC within 4 years. Henry Ford Community College is located near the corners of Ford and Evergreen Roads. Visit hfcc.edu for more details. The choice is clear. Henry Ford Community College, your best choice, guaranteed.
This is DJ Bam from the Journey in a Trance Show and Midnight Mix, here to announce the second ever WHFR Electronic Music Benefits Show. Come join other WHFR listeners and electronic music fans from around the world on Friday, May 22nd at Studio 54. Studio 54 is located at 400 Bagley Avenue in Detroit at the corner of Cass, inside the Leland Hotel. The show will feature music from local DJs, all whom have played on the Journey in a Trance show before, including DJ Detroit, Mr. Busy, Donald Juan, Charles in Charge, and DJ Motorsoul. This is an 18 and up event, and doors will open at 9 p.m. Cover is only $5 for the 21 and up before midnight, and $5 per person that attends this event will be donated to WHFR.fm. For more information, call WHFR at 313-317-6541 or email us at whfr@hfcc.edu. So come join WHFR as we kick off the Detroit Electronic Music Weekend at Studio 54, Friday, May 22nd at 9 p.m.
Sorry about that pregnant pause there, folks. Our public service announcements just concluded. We now have Mark Gaffney on the line, the Michigan president of the AFL-CIO. Are you there, Mark?
I am. Good afternoon.
Well, it's very good to have you spend some time with us and talking about the issues of the day here in the state of Michigan. I do have, actually, and Susan Morrell is here with us, and we'll begin asking you some questions, too. But just to let people know that besides being president of Michigan State AFL-CIO, that organization does represent nearly 1 million active and retired union members. And that includes myself, in fact, because I'm a member of the American Federation of Teachers, Local 1650, here at Henry Ford Community College. So, more than 40 different affiliated unions, too, in our state. I guess 65 or more unions nationwide?
Yes, that's right.
Wow. And I wasn't aware of the extent of that. I sort of knew about the Teamsters and the Steelworkers and... just in terms of unions, but AFL-CIO is really the largest umbrella organization helping to support and to lobby for these unions. So,
and you'd be surprised to know that we have a very active Screen Actors Guild union here.
Yes,
IATSE, the stagehands for movies and television.
And maybe we're going to need them.
AFTRA, Federation of Radio. Performers.
Yes.
Very big in Michigan.
Yes, I noticed that too. So a whole range of professionals, not just, you might say, the people that work with their hands, but all kinds of craftspeople, including professionals like I know nurses and postal workers and just an amazing range of people with varying needs, but somehow with common needs too, in terms of trying to be trying to get their important issues heard by their employers and of course our legislative bodies. So let's get started. We know that you'd like to talk about, and we'd like to hear your comments on the unemployed and maybe even Jennifer Granholm's success or lack of success in the state of Michigan. We never get enough state of Michigan news here locally. It seems to be sort of a black hole. A lot of the Detroit papers have cut back in their coverage. But I know that Susan especially wanted to hear about the major effort nationwide and talk a little bit about the Employee Free Choice Act. Do you want to start, Susan?
Yes. Hello, Mr. Gaffney, and welcome to WHFR.
Thank you. Hello.
Thank you for joining us here today. And I know that there's been some talk about the Employee Free Choice Act, but unfortunately I'm not hearing enough in the media about it. So I'm not sure if everyone is aware of actually what it is, and perhaps you can shed some light on that and tell us what it is and why are you supporting it as the AFL-CIO and why do we need it?
Thank you. Well, in 1935, we passed what was called the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act. It's still in place, but it's been amended a couple of times, and the interpretation of the act is through, like every other law, hearings and judicial hearings and case law. This law, which established how workers could join unions and all of the rules pertaining to that, has, we believe, been amended and changed too much so that it now overwhelmingly benefits employers. That's the idea behind the Employee Free Choice Act of 2009, but actually we had the bill in the U.S. Congress, this is federal legislation, in the last session. We gained a majority in both houses in the last session, but of course President Bush would not sign it, and we didn't have enough votes to stop the filibuster, but there was majority support. What the bill does is basically three things. It gives the choice of how to form a union to the workers. Today, the employer can insist on an election run by the government. When the Wagner Act was first passed, employers did not insist on that. Most of the unions we know today organized by signing a card. The workers saying, we want to be represented by a union, and they signed a card saying so, and when a majority of the cards were accumulated, they were presented to the employer, and the bargaining relationship began. But after, I think it was 1949, and again in the 80s through case law, the law was changed to let employers have the choice. So what happens is employers always choose the election process, and then almost every one of them, in almost every case, the employers drag that process out. It becomes very divisive, oftentimes bitter. People are fired. And what started as a simple question, would you like to form a union here at your work site, yes or no, ends up with a very long, in many cases months and months, sometimes years, election process with an awful lot of threats and intimidation and trouble, frankly. So what we want to do is say to the workers, if you want to join a union, you can have a secret ballot election. 30% of you have to ask the government for that. Or if you want to show that you have a majority support based on signature cards, a majority of you can ask for that. That's one thing the law would do. The other thing the law would do is put more teeth into effect when employers break the law. It's illegal to fire people for organizing a union, but 1 in 5 union activists are fired for joining a union. It's illegal to say the plant will close, but in over half of the cases, employers tell employees if the union comes in, we're closing down. There's just not enough penalties. There's just not enough teeth. The third thing the law does, or the legislation does, is create a system for binding arbitration, a end, if you will, to the negotiation process after 4 months. Today, when we win an election, half of those do not result in a contract. In other words, half of the bargaining units, half of the work sites who actually go through an election and say, we want a union, never get one, because the employers end up fighting this and going through a whole lot of legal machinations, avoiding bargaining, avoiding agreement, and the union eventually goes away. People in the worksite change over, This could take years. It has taken years. In Petoskey, we organized nurses. We had three elections. Three elections that the union won, and in the end, there's still no contract there.
Well, my understanding, Mr. Gaffney, and the last time I was up north, was the nurses' unions were on strike at the time, and a relative of mine needed to go to the hospital, and when they got there, there was no one there to take care of them, and they had to be flown down to Ann Arbor for medical emergency. Now, are they still on strike?
No, they've actually, the battle, if you will, has ended, and the workers changed over enough, because once the union nurses did go on strike looking for representation and a contract, they were replaced with other nurses. So there should have been someone there at the hospital, of course. And as time went on, you had the union supporters on strike and the people that did not support the unions working. So there's no contract, there's no union there today. That's an example of a three-year fight that ended up without a union.
And then the union nurses were replaced.
Right. And you see, that's wrong. I mean, go back 3 years from that terrible ending and the terrible fight that took place for 3 years. A majority of people at that work site said, we want a union. And actually, as I say, ended up having to say that in a vote three different times over 2 different years. So this whole overall system doesn't work for workers. It ends up with rather bitter election process that just could be done so much better.
Well,
and
our
thought that the Employee Free Choice Act will do that.
Yeah, I mean, I like to use real examples from the real world that are so relevant to people. So those nurses that had jobs up there in Petoskey actually had to probably leave that location and go elsewhere and perhaps even out of state in order to find another job.
Well, that's exactly right. And what was in their favor, of course, is they're highly skilled, highly trained, highly educated people, and they did find jobs, but not in Petoskey.
Of course.
almost all had to leave town, yeah.
I mean, this is a terrible scenario, and it was a terrible medical emergency for a member, in fact, two members of my family who happened to get sick over the holiday weekend. And lo and behold, everyone goes up north on vacation thinking, if I get sick, someone will be there to take care of me. And then there wasn't anybody there. So it's, you know, you never know how this may affect you. You might not be a member of a union, right? But you might need someone who's in a union to take care of you, a medical emergency, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so
firefighters, police officers.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, EMS people who come to rescue you, those kinds of things. But one of the things you mentioned in your explanation of the Employee Free Choice Act was the secret ballot issue and also majority sign-up. What are employees doing currently? Do they have secret ballots? Do they have majority sign-up?
The way the process works now is employees actually do currently use a signature card. And the card says, do you wish to be represented by such and such a union for the purpose of collective bargaining? When a majority of those cards are signed, someone, generally an organizer from the union, will go to the company and say, I have a majority of your workers who want to join a union. Will you voluntarily recognize us? There's actually a question on the form that we have to turn into the government that says that. Did you ask the employer for voluntary recognition? In the years before the 1980s, generally speaking, some employers would say, yeah, you have a majority, I'll recognize you, let's start the process. But nowadays, most employers put up a fight and don't voluntarily agree to this. So today, the way the process works, you take the majority of those cards to the government, to the National Labor Relations Board. There's an office in Grand Rapids and an office in Detroit. They have lawyers, they have staff people, and they'll call up the employer and say, I've got 57 cards here, you have 90 employees, send me over your employee list so I can compare them. The the boss is not supposed to ever see the cards, just the government sees them. And if the government says, yep, there's a majority there, what do you want to do? The boss gets to answer the question. And like I say, the boss at the company will almost always choose an election. And then they start delaying tactics. You use the law, you adjourn the hearing, you ask for another hearing on another matter. You don't like the day the government set. You don't like who the union says they want to organize. You think it ought to include the truck drivers as well as the production people. And there's just a whole lot of ways you can delay this stuff. In the meantime, companies will often hire consultants who come in and teach them how to win these elections.
But those are these considered secret ballots at this time, the way it's run?
Well, what is secret about it is when you stand in the little booth, and it's a very clever little booth that the government brings along, made out of aluminum with a little curtain on it, and you cast your ballot in secret. However, these consultants that employers hire know how everyone votes. Unions try to know how everyone is going to vote because we need to continue to build toward majority. And if this process goes on too long, that's where the divisiveness comes in. You have both sides trying to talk people into voting a particular way. And oftentimes what happens is people who wanted a union originally become intimidated. They become scared. Most employers will have what they call captive audience meetings. This is a meeting that you must attend because you're being paid, and the employers will tell you all about why they don't want the union. Many employers have one-on-one meetings with employees. 78% of employers have one-on-one meetings with the employee and their supervisor. These are very intimidating.
That would be.
And be threatening.
It would be very intimidating.
And again, there's a whole host of things that the law says employers should not do, but the penalty for it literally, you're not going to believe me here, but literally it is posting a notice. You post a notice on an employee bulletin board that says, I told you the place would close down if the union came in. It was illegal for me to say that. I won't do it again.
Mm. Let me just ask you this. Since we have people who are listening to this, what can our audience do about the Employee Free Choice Act if they're in favor of it? What can they do now? How can they become proactive?
Well, if they're in favor or quite honestly opposed to it, they can call their congressperson and weigh in their concerns. Why do we need this? Do we need it to help unions? Look, I am calling you, I'm talking to you from my nice office in Lansing. Workers need this bill. Mm-hmm. Non-union workers need this bill. The New York Times said, not me at the union, the New York Times said in December of last year, the average hourly increase in wages was one penny for the last 4 years. So from 2003 to 2007, the average worker gained one penny in their hourly wage after inflation. Those are the workers that need to say to their boss, to their supervisor, we want to bargain collectively as a group because we don't think we're getting our fair share here.
We're talking with Mark Gaffney, who's the Michigan State AFL-CIO president, here on WHFR.FM, Station Making Waves. And I'd just like to say, too, as a comment on this, is that I've read the most of the employee free choice bill, and it just seems to be sort of fine-tuning but necessary for some of the problems that have resulted so far. And I don't see why some of the conservative talk shows like on Fox TV channel and so on are so bent out of shape on this. Not only is the cost issue effectively it hasn't been that different when you get a union, but it's unbelievable the some of the negativity, although that's the nature of getting TV ratings these days, to be sensational about anything that's available. To me, I'm in this show is not necessarily representing the opinions of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College other than me and Susan Morrell, of course, but it just seems to be so rational and protective. And our listeners know, I've been a union member here with the teacher union for 40 years, and my dad before that at Chrysler Corporation, on the line assembly worker. It's the protection too. That's why they need the union, is to help support the people, not just sure a good solid contract and a decent pay, but you know, the additional protection against abuses to their hours and the way they're treated in the workplace is just so important. And you don't have that if you don't have a union.
Well, you don't. And when you look across America and you say what kind of worker needs the union the most, it's the same kind of worker that America needs to make more wages and to have health care. Let me tell you what I mean by that. The majority of people without health care in America today have jobs. They are the working poor. Their employers don't pay them enough. They work in restaurants or in Walmart or in stores or in hotels that if they raise their prices pennies, if they raise their prices single-digit percents, they could pay their workers more and provide health care for their workers. We're talking about 2 or 3 pennies on a can of tomatoes would provide a union and insurance and 1/3 more wages for people that pick those tomatoes. Now, I got to believe most Americans would say, I'll pay 2.5 cents more for my can of tomatoes so that the people who pick them can have insurance and a living wage. That's really what we're talking about. We're talking about the hundreds of thousands of low-wage workers who need a break, and they're too afraid now to form a union. They're too afraid now to ask for more at their employers. And so this law will make forming a union safer for those workers, quicker for those workers, and easier for those workers.
Yes, Mr. Gaffney, I do agree with that for low-wage workers. But, you know, here in the state of Michigan, we've been in a recession for a number of years now. I think really since 2001, we went into a recession here in the state of Michigan, and we really never recovered from it in terms of the job market. And now, with this current economic climate of all the Wall Street financial disasters on the whole country, Michigan is right at the top of the list as far as unemployment. And many employees are now working temporary jobs, and they're not the lowest paid workers, but they don't have any benefits. And we're at almost 13% unemployment here in the state of Michigan. I'm sure that's an underreported percentage. But what would you say about the unemployed in the state of Michigan and the whole country regarding some of these issues and what the AFL-CIO is trying to do?
One of the reasons this recession hit so hard, and one of the reasons it's going to stick around as long as it will, is that workers have lost their purchasing power. I gave you that article from the New York Times. 70% of our gross domestic product in America is consumer activity, is consumer spending. And when consumers stop spending, that's what this time in part has stalled out the economy. Workers need, middle-class people need, discretionary income. They need money in their pocket, so to speak, so that they can help move this economy along. You don't have extra money in your pocket if you're a low-wage worker. If you're working in a plant that's not organized and the plant next door does basically the same thing, but the workers over there make 1/3 more, you ought to be making more in that case. And don't forget, this law, of course, would go in place across the whole country. So if it results, as we hope it does, as we expect it would, if it results in more union members, that would be more union members in every other state in the country, and Michigan would not be at a wage disadvantage. In fact, we have at least one Republican member of Congress who hasn't agreed to the bill yet, but who might agree to support it. And if so, the reason they would is because they think this will lead to the UAW and other unions organizing the transplanted international auto companies who have located in other states. If that happens, that's a very good thing for Michigan. Frankly, it's a very good thing for the Big Three, because then those companies could end up with the same type of collective bargaining that the Big Three have up here in Michigan and Ohio and other traditional union states. It's really, the other way to put that is, it's really time that all workers across the country enjoyed an opportunity to have more wages and benefits.
Well, Mr. Gaffney, I'm sorry we kept you a little over the time we said we were going to talk to you today, but we really, really appreciate your being here and talking about Employee Free Choice Act and the unemployment situation in Michigan. Again, folks, we're listening. We've been talking to Michigan State AFL-CIO President Mark T. Gaffney. You're doing a great job with all these union members, over a million active and retired members in Michigan. Have you been, just one final insight, have you been daily giving input to the UAW discussions with GM? And
no, I'm happy.
Well, that's good. You're out of that.
It's been very difficult negotiations. Yeah. I know, both for that company and for that union. They've both been through so much. I look at it, and your listeners should too, as one of the good parts of a union relationship with a company. You've got management and union sitting down saying, what can we do to make sure these companies come out of bankruptcy or stay out or, you know, make it through the next couple of years.
Right.
But when individual unions do that individually, the AFL is in a cheering and a supportive role, but we don't take a direct role.
Yeah, we reported first on the show today about a New York Times article from just this morning that UAW and GM had come to some agreement yesterday, but look at the bondholders won't, and so bankruptcy is looming unless those bondholders want to change their opinion by next Tuesday. So we wish the best for those folks, but keep up the struggle. I know personally how important a good union and union support is for any career, any job that you're in, and it's not just the money, although sometimes wages are way lower than what they need to be. You mentioned nurses, just as a final thought, too. I have some relatives in the nursing profession, working in hospitals as doctors, too, and it's hours and scheduling that's driving them crazy, you know.
That's exactly right.
The pay is not too bad, but it's unbelievable. 3 days on, double shifts sometimes, and then off, and it's, unless you're young enough, it's a killer, you know, and well, mistakes can happen in those situations, too.
Right.
Don't want to think about that. Well, thank you again for all the time
thank
today.
You.
We are honored with your comments, and we'll keep up with what's happening. We want to tell our listeners, of course, they're the website aflcio.org, and you can get a link to all of the active legislative issues right there. So thank you for your time again.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay. I appreciate it.
Thank you, President Gaffney.
You're welcome.
And to go to their website at miaflcio.org for the Michigan AFL-CIO, and they have lots of issues there that you might be interested in if you're interested in workers bettering their lot in Michigan and the whole United States. The Employee Free Choice Act, the Hire Michigan First package, and then they have a number of priority issues for the AFL-CIO. Of course, that includes health care.
Right. Thanks so much for your call. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Bye now.
Bye-bye. Well, we're very honored to have Mark Gaffney on the show today. And again, technology permitting, we're down to one channel again. So if you have a stereo receiver, you heard Mr. Gaffney according to my meters here, the left channel, but maybe at your house it's the right channel. But in any event, we hope you were able to appreciate that unions have a point of view. It's never expressed on Fox TV News Channel, that's for sure, on cable. Channel 2 in Detroit does some of it because that's a broadcast outlet of Fox. But just so you know, the pundits don't ever seem to give equal time, a fair amount of time to union points of view. And I know they have valid points of view, and I've seen them work in action. And so WHFR Journal, hey, we're local views news and those alternative views, and actually union views are almost an alternative view, I'm sorry to say, these days. But there's a lot to understand, and even if you're a business employer out there, maybe if you learn more about actually what these changes in the law that the AFL-CIO is supporting, maybe when you actually find out more about their side of it, you'd see there's some reason to it and some valid rationale. We've got to close up shop here. We're waiting for Joanne Kay, who's just coming into the studio to start our Highway 61 Blues show today. We want to thank all our listeners for listening. A comment here, and I can't go into it much, but Memorial Day is coming up Monday, and of course the parade is Monday morning here in Dearborn down Michigan Avenue from approximately Michigan and Greenfield, but of course it ends at Schaefer and Michigan. Yes, at the City Hall, of course, and as I said, they're closing off some parking around there, so in advance, so you perhaps want to bicycle down or walk down from parking a few blocks away. Of course, it's an important time to remember the service, our U.S. servicemen, but
and women.
Yes, all of the people that have fought our wars, justified or not. And we've mentioned before a newspaper called the American Free Press. There is an online version, AmericanFreePress.com or .org, you know, and I don't have that on the sheet here. But they do publish a weekly newspaper that is very interesting. It does seem to be very alternative. It is sort of conspiracy theory oriented about things. But their special issue for Monday, and they say, hey, we're a nationalist, not a pacifist newspaper. We believe in a strong national defense, and it's vital to defend America first. We respect our men and women in uniform and support them wholeheartedly. However, the headline of this special 8-page publication from American Free Press, national newspaper, say, U.S. servicemen caught in the middle between patriotism and profiteers. And so you might want to read about that. Who's making a profit on these wars? Is it really the excuse for the war? Why we got